Nobody wants to get that first.
Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, February 25th, 2015, will come to order. Okay, we have the continuation of the Ag Department's budget today, so who do you want up next, Commissioner?
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, for the record, Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we're going to continue on today with our Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and they are here introducing themselves and ready to testify. I would add, while they're getting ready, that in the next couple hours, I think we'll get our final edits on a one-page spreadsheet of all of the fees and the increases that the Chair and others, including Senator Ingebrigtsen, wanted to just kind of a handy reference of what was done, what's currently being done, what the current fee intake is, what the proposed fee intake is, what it would be used for. So giving you kind of a one-pager on all of those indicators should be to you all today.
You can fit them all on one page?
Can indeed.
I'll make it big enough for us to read.
Let's go. Okay.
Okay, who wants to go first? Just say your name for the record and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Bozicki, and I'm the Division Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management. What I'll do today is provide an overview of the division responsibilities relatively briefly. We will talk about several change items, but Mr. Chair, listening to your questions the other day, we only actually have one fee increase, which I'll bring to your attention. We've got a couple of other ones that have some fiscal adjustments, and then with me is my assistant director, Dan Stoddard, and he will talk with the clean water appropriations. And Mr. Chair, if I can begin. The Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division is responsible for almost all aspects of pesticide and fertilizer use, storage, and handling, et cetera, in the state. So if it deals with pesticides...
Do we have a handout here?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. No, we don't have a handout. I'm going to be speaking directly from the budget book, and
right.
I'm on page 55, which
right.
is a division overview. And then we'll be going to the change items in the budget book. So page 55 provides the overview.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do virtually everything, almost all activities relating to pesticides and fertilizers are regulated by the division. On page 55 in the center, you see a laundry list of services that we provide. We have a very comprehensive and broad program. So we're engaged in everything from voluntary practices to service practices, such as picking up waste pesticides that are no longer being used by citizens, to regulatory inspections, to cleanups of contaminated sites. Significant amount of our authority was provided in the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989, along with funding. Basically, we have fees that are collected on pesticide products, pesticide licenses, and so forth, and we have similar programs or similar revenue streams for fertilizers. I would make a couple of points to this A committee. We do have some relatively outstanding or unique programs in the state of Minnesota, and this is, I think, very appropriate given the amount of water and the concern about water in the state. So, for example, we have collected a tremendous amount of waste pesticides over the last 25 years. We've collected about 5.8 million pounds of waste pesticide. That's waste pesticide that is not available for movement to our surface water, our groundwater. We have a very elaborate pesticide monitoring program. And Mr. Stoddard will talk about one of the nitrate monitoring programs that we've just initiated relatively recently. But we've been monitoring groundwater since 1985 and surface water since 1991. We do pesticide misuse investigations, so if there is any complaints either from urban or rural folks. We engage those and respond to those. Of course, relatively recently, there's been a lot of discussion about pollinators and pesticides, and we do inspections of that nature as well. And finally, as a special program, I mentioned the ACRA program, which over the years has, through surcharges that are on pesticide and fertilizer products and dealers and applicators, has provided $34 million in cleanup of contaminated sites. A lot of these sites are ag chem facilities that are located in or around small towns and potential drinking water contamination sources. Many of those have been cleaned up over the years. And the committee can take a look at some of the comments at the bottom of page 55. If they'd like additional information, of course, we'd be happy to respond to any questions about our division. But if we could move to page 42, I can talk about the fee initiative that we're proposing.
Senator Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, this...
Hang on. Senator Scalzi. Sorry.
Before we get off your services provided, I'm just kind of curious, will you interface at all with the DNR EAW that's being proposed in the Pines to Potatoes area relating to nitrates and groundwater?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, yes, we will be. We have we do a lot of work in nitrogen best management practices and monitoring. Mr. Stoddard can talk a little bit more about those programs under clean water. But yes, we work closely with the DNR, and we anticipate that we will be very much involved in the nitrate aspects of that EAW.
Good question.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead. Page 42, is that what you said?
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair, page 42. This is a change item in which we are asking for a fee increase of 9 cents per ton of agricultural fertilizer. Currently, our fee is at 70 cents per ton, so we're asking for a 7.8% increase. This fee is designated to deal with anhydrous ammonia fertilizer inspections and safety, and also bulk liquid fertilizer inspections. And the bulk liquid fertilizer is a more of an environmental risk than a safety risk. For those members who are unfamiliar with anhydrous ammonia and nitrogen fertilizer, nitrogen is kind of the driver for crop production in many crops. And anhydrous ammonia as a gas is a very inexpensive, most inexpensive fertilizer material that a farmer can use. Unfortunately, it's very hazardous. It's stored under pressure as a gas, and it can be very dangerous. It is hydrophilic, which means it loves water. So that means if you inhale it, it loves the water in your lungs, and it will burn you. We have had a number of incidents over the years. We respond to releases and so forth. But back in 2010, we had several deaths. And as a result of that, we brought forward to the legislature a general fund, a request for a fee increase, which ended up as being a general fund appropriation. And what we've done with those dollars is increase our inspection routine. We have 278 facilities located in and around in rural areas. About 70% of those are located near or in small towns. And so what we have done is increased our inspection routine from an average of once every 6.8 years to once every 3 years. And part of this fee increase will be dedicated to maintaining that inspection rotation of getting to these facilities on a regular routine inspection basis once every 3 years. We believe that we work closely with the industry. Of course, we regulate them as well. But through our outreach efforts and through our inspection protocols, we believe we've improved the safety. Of course, proving that is another issue. It's always difficult to prove a negative. But we believe that it is important to maintain this inspection protocol. We will also be looking at about We will also be looking at outreach to growers. About 5% of our nurse tanks are owned by growers, and we have not had the dollars really to focus on this, but we would like to use some of this dollars to really focus a safety outreach to farmers who own these tanks and make sure that they're maintained properly and so forth.
Senator Gabretzky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a question I have is the fatalities you talk about, is that farmer fatalities, or is it based out of the distribution sites? And does not the producer of the anhydrous ammonia, the product itself, does not have some safety training for farmers and farm hands that actually apply it? But can you talk specifically real quickly about the fatalities, where they were? And
sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there were two fatalities at a transfer station down in Dakota County. These were people, drivers and managers. They were loading a transportation vehicle. Something went wrong, and anhydrous ammonia was released, and two of them were injured and killed. Another incident was actually, if I recall correctly, a employee of an A-chem facility who was doing some maintenance on a applicator, and there was a release. They thought the particular equipment that he was working on was empty, and it wasn't, and he bled it off. It was anhydrous ammonia was released at that time. I would say, though, there is safety training. We provide safety training. The industry provides safety training. But what we're looking at is actually going above and beyond that to actually reach out to some of the growers and so forth who may not necessarily be exposed to it, try to make it even easier for them to obtain the precautions and so forth. I would say a couple of other things I would just mention for the committee's awareness is that while these are a couple of unfortunate deaths that we had several years ago, we do have incidents on an annual basis where people are exposed and may be injured to a lesser degree. And then we also have releases where folks will have to be evacuated from neighboring areas. So this has decreased over time, and we think a lot of it has to do with our increased attention to inspections and the increased attention that we brought and helped bring to the industry for safety. But we think that it would be appropriate to maintain that and even increase the amount of training and information that's out there.
So Mr. Chair, just to follow up quickly, so we're not moving towards the farmer-producer mandatory training or anything like that, are we? I mean, that's there. It's optional for them to understand that. And you would wonder how I know anything about this. I along with my, at that time, soon-to-be father-in-law, hit the dust with an anhydrous tank spill, actually. So we hit the dust and crawled out of that, and so I know exactly how dangerous they are. But that was error on myself and him. So we're not going to be doing any of that mandatory stuff. I mean, they know the dangers of this.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, this won't be mandatory. This will be outreach. We're not proposing any new regulations.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, the other half of the initiative actually deals with another fertilizer source. This is a liquid fertilizer, liquid nitrogen. Although there can be a variety of nutrients, the gist of it is that there was a big expansion of bulk liquid storage at A-chem facilities, at some farms, but largely A-chem facilities back in the early 90s. We permit those. But we do not have the resources to go out and do routine inspections. What has happened is a lot of these tanks are reaching their length of service, if you will. We're seeing releases, and when these releases occur, if the tanks aren't properly maintained, there can be significant impact to groundwater. So what we would like to do is use the additional resources, half the money, to deal with outreach, but also to hire an inspector and focus on these bulk liquid tanks, because it's easier to do the prevention through the inspection than it is to do the cleanup. We have about 417 tanks that are between 20 and 30,000 gallons. and we have another 30 tanks that are over 50,000 gallons. We are anticipating about an 18% increase in storage. So not only do we have the old facilities, but we have additional permitting that we need to do. So we're asking for this increase in fertilizer tonnage to increase inspections and to address the problem now as opposed to letting it go and doing the cleanup and the expensive environmental remediation. So, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions on that initiative, I can move on to the next
two. So is that fee increase the $250,000 that I see in the budget there?
Mr. Chair, yes. This is a $250,000 increase. It's about about a penny per acre for row crops, and it's about a 7.8% increase in our funds right now.
And how does this compare to the fee we heard about the other day that didn't cost any more to inspect regardless of the size of the – is the size of the farm more expensive here? Is it – or is it the amount of fertilizer is the key, or what's the key here?
Mr. Chair, the key is anhydrous ammonia and this bulk storage so that we'd be focused on that material. That material is used obviously fertilizer is not used on organic production, but this material can be used on any size farm, big and small. And if there is a release on anhydrous ammonia, it's possible for a farmer, an applicator, an industry person to be injured. If there's a release at the bulk fertilizer, we're all going to pay for cleanup.
My question is, does it cost more to do a bigger farm than it does to do a smaller farm, or is it the inspection fee the same for all?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. No, it's size neutral.
Okay.
The fee is added to the fertilizer product as it is being purchased, regardless whether you purchase a large or small amount in bulk. And that it's just increasing the system that we already have. So it's size neutral.
So the larger farm will pay more, essentially.
If the more you purchase, the more you pay. It's on a per ton basis.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead. Senator Scully, do you have a question? No.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, if you'll turn to page 48, this is a change level. And it's listed here because we anticipate that we will be getting a few more people and facilities licensed as a result of this change. It is not a fee increase. Rather, what we're doing is we're adjusting some of our categories in which we license people. We're making some adjustments to that. And in doing that, when we have different categories of pesticide applicators, they all have to go through training. So by combining some of these categories and adjusting it a certain way, we'll be able to get more efficiencies out of our training on that. So that's one of the things that's taking place. The other thing that probably is going to be the main cause for the fiscal impact is the fact that we're actually deregulating, if you will, taking out of statute terms, devices, and procedures. So if the committee will indulge me briefly, most of us think of pesticides as chemicals, but in the statute it also says that we regulate devices and procedures. What this means is that if a person is involved in pesticide or pest elimination from a house, say through carpentry or something like that, to seal up holes that bats are coming in. Technically, what they need to do is to go through a very detailed licensing procedure for chemicals, even though they're not interested in using chemicals. What we would like to do is clarify that and make it clear that you can get a commercial license, but you don't have to go through all of that training. And we do that simply by removing devices and procedures from the statute. We believe that we will get a number of additional companies and additional licensed people who would like to be seen as licensed, but they don't have to go through all of that training to just use devices and procedures.
Okay.
So Mr. Chair, members, it's basically a technical change. We've worked with the industry on this. They're comfortable with this, and but we actually think that more people will actually come in to be licensed because it will be easier for them to do so. and they're not going to be using pesticides and fertilizers, so it's not going to be an issue for safety for the average consumer.
Streamlining, that's good.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would add support to what Mr. Bozicki just said with regard to this. There are a number of individuals that are doing this type of, it's actually bat control without any pesticides, and they were having to go through this very complicated procedure for getting licenses for pesticides which they weren't using. So I think this is a really good change and will bring those people into licensure without them having to go through that part of it, which they're not utilizing. So
we had a bat problem at my cabin too, and before the kid burnt it down, so the problem's gone now. But
I would have given you the name of Wally the Bat Guy if you'd come and fix that for you.
Mr. Chair, so did I understand that you burned the cabin down to get rid of the bats?
That may be what it sounded like, however.
For the record.
That's right. Mr. Chair, I remind you that the Commissioner of Commerce and Insurance is right behind me. So.
Statute of limitations is long past.
Up there, that's 2 days.
Mr. Chair, the last change item that I'll be referring to is on page 49, and this is really a technical change. Basically, what we're going to do is align some of the language in the statute to make it very clear that in order to purchase a restricted use product, you need to be licensed. So you need to be licensed to purchase and to use. Currently, this is the way the rule reads. This is the way the provision that applies to the dealer reads. But we want to be perfectly clear that in order to purchase, you must be licensed. Licensed to purchase and to use. So by adding the purchase component into the statute, that will align all of those. The reason for the fiscal impact is actually we anticipate an outreach expenditure of about $1,000 to make sure people are aware of this. What this does is it simply aligns it. It still will allow for some of you may be aware that if you are a licensed applicator, and let's say you're in the field, you're busy working, and you need another gallon of a product, you can still send, according to our rules, you can still send an employee in or a family member in to actually do the pickup, because that's the licensed person, even if that person's on the tractor, is actually doing the purchasing. So it does not affect that. So there's no change in policy. It's just a clarification. And it makes it perfectly clear that it is the responsibility of the applicator to be licensed when they purchase. Mr. Chair, that's all I have on our change items and the division overview. And unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Stoddard, who will talk about our clean water fund initiatives.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Stoddard.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and I'm going to be going over the...
Why don't you pull that microphone closer?
Oh, sure. And I'm going to be going over the Clean Water Legacy funding amendments.
Closer.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Okay, that's better. All right.
Again, for the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and I'm going to be going over the Department of Agriculture's Clean Water Fund requests. I'm going to go off the budget book on page 50 to 52. I'll note that the title is wrong. I apologize for that. I think the title is Pesticide Monitoring. In reality, we've got all of our clean water funding initiatives under that one change item. We have 9 different program areas. This is a little different from the other change items in that the department's required to go back for renewed funding every 2 years. We have 8 program areas that are pre-existing. 2 have funding increases, 2 have funding decreases, and then we have 1 new program area. And we also deleted 1 program area. The total number of FTEs hasn't changed significantly. I think it's about 2/10 more than we had previously. The Department of Agriculture has an important role in helping to address non-point source contamination from agricultural sources. We have statutory responsibilities for addressing pesticides and fertilizers in groundwater and for helping develop, demonstrate, and promote fertilizer best management practices. And we work closely with the other water agencies, ag community, and local governments in addressing these needs. So our first request is number one on page 50. It's pesticide monitoring. Several years ago, the Department of Agriculture requested and received funding for a new state-of-the-art instrument, an LC-MS-MS. What it is it's an analytical instrument in our laboratory that's capable of running a lot more compounds at much lower detection limits. And so we have this instrument. It's actually our second one. We also got one through LCCMR funds. And this funding is simply to run it. And so we need two chemists, and then we need some staff time to process the samples, and then there's consumables as part of that too. So that's about $350,000 per year in order to run the samples. And what we get is an increase in about 600 samples per year, and we get much lower detection levels and a much longer suite of contaminants. Our next proposal, number two on page 50, is nitrate in groundwater.
So how many pesticides do we have? You're going from detectable pesticides from 43 in 2009 to 129 in 2014.
Mr. Chair, I forgot the exact number of active ingredients that are registered in the state of Minnesota, but there's over 1,000 active ingredients. And each of those is used in a different way. Typically what we look for are agricultural herbicides and sometimes insecticides that are used in larger quantities in the field. And so pesticides do get into the environment. When you apply them to a field, there's always some runoff. And every year we review the chemicals that are used, the amount that they're used, where they're used, and we come up with an analytical list, and then we work with our laboratory to identify those compounds that we should look for. And we also work with the Department of Health and Pollution Control Agency, and they advise us on the list also.
What do you do when you find them?
Well, we have an annual report that we summarize all of the data, and then we have an advisory committee that includes quite a few members of different backgrounds, including the other agencies. We share all of the data with this advisory group. We also share it with the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency, and then we ask them to provide advice to us on whether we need to either develop best management practices, or we also have regulatory authority to change practices if we need to. And so it's an ongoing process that's outlined in our state pesticide management plan. It's a very formal process, and we think we've got a pretty good program that tracks these pretty aggressively.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, number two is on page 50. It's nitrate in groundwater. The Department of Agriculture is the lead state agency for addressing nitrate in groundwater, and nitrate in groundwater can be a significant concern in certain parts of the state. In general, anywhere where the groundwater is vulnerable and you have row crop agriculture, there's a risk of nitrates getting into groundwater. And it's especially common in southeast Minnesota where you have karst and the central sand plains of Minnesota. What we do with this funding is we fund a variety of different kinds of activities that are designed to address nitrate in groundwater. The department is completing a revision of the state nitrogen fertilizer management plan, and that is the state blueprint that outlines a process for how we're going to address this concern. Much of the funding is used for pass-through to local governments for education on best management practices and appropriate practices for irrigation and for other activities. We also work with the University of Minnesota to refine the BMPs and evaluate them and make sure that they're appropriate and accurate. We work with local governments and local farmers to address areas that have elevated nitrates. A lot of our work is spent in trying to prevent nitrate contamination by promoting good practices. But in areas that have elevated nitrates, we have a formal response for how we address them. We also have a significant increase in monitoring for nitrates. So we monitor for nitrates in high-risk areas in the state. We also monitor for pesticides in areas where nitrates are detected. And then we conduct farm surveys through the National Agricultural Statistics Survey and other tools to identify actual practices so that when we're addressing this concern, we have solid data. A couple of projects that we work on. There's a lot of work under here, but I'm just going to point out a few that are pretty well known, I think, and pretty popular. One is that we have a demonstration site at Rorschach Farm. It's a public-private partnership to evaluate irrigation management practices. And we work closely with the University of Minnesota and others to evaluate those practices. And we have a lot of different stakeholders, local SWCD, Prairie Lakes Co-op, University of Minnesota, and others. We also have irrigation workshops. We work with number of counties in central Minnesota to promote irrigation management practices, irrigation scheduling. It's been a very popular program that has pretty high participation. It's actively supported by the Minnesota Irrigators Association. We also are doing much more extensive township testing. So as part of the nitrogen fertilizer management plan, we are proposing to test all, or offer for test, all of the private wells in areas where there's vulnerable groundwater across the state and rural crop agriculture. And so we've initiated that effort. It's going to be a six-year effort. We anticipate sampling up to 70,000 private wells, and we're 2 years into that effort. Mr. Chair, our third request is on number three on page 50. It's for Ag Nonpoint Research and Evaluation. This is for formal academic research and evaluation activities. Almost all of the funding under this area is pass-through funding. There's a need for research to address specific information gaps, and this is specifically in support of the impaired waters process. We've got a number of goals through this. We try to identify underlying processes that affect ag water quality, from agriculture that affect water quality, evaluate the effectiveness of agricultural BMPs, and develop technologies to target critical areas. The priorities that we use for research are developed from an interagency research team. Again, this is all done through a formal RFP process. Anyone can do the research. Most of the money does go to a university, but sometimes we have private entities that also come in and have a good idea of getting funded for it. And then we have a very professional external stakeholder team that reviews the proposals and makes the selection. Some of the projects that we funded have been very innovative. Most recently, we spent a lot of money focusing on vegetative cover. I think right now we're funding four projects at the University of Minnesota for about $1 million for vegetative cover. We've also recently developed something called the Ag BMP Handbook. That was an academic review of all of the Minnesota-specific available research on best management practices. This handbook got an award for innovation from the Consulting Engineers Council, and it's being used as part of the impaired waters process to make sure that local governments and other state agencies, when they're evaluating impaired waters, are using good data. And so it's been a very useful tool, and right now we're planning on revising that and then also making it available online for an electronic format. Another activity that we fund, which has been very popular, and I think it's unique, is the Clay County Ag Drainage Site. So Clay County is in the Red River Basin, and drainage is a major concern in that part of the state. But there really was very little information on drainage practices and drainage impacts. And so with the support of the other agencies and the ag community, we have a site in Clay County which has multiple replications of actual drainage. And so we're able to evaluate flow characteristics and also contaminant characteristics coming off of that site. And it's extremely useful information for evaluating the effect of nitrogen BMPs on surface waters in areas where it's drained. It's also extremely useful for evaluating flow characteristics, and a number of other researchers have also got involved in some of our demonstration work.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you. Are any of those plots tiled?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, they are all tiled.
They're all tiled.
Sorry, these are tiled evaluations.
And so you have managing the outlets, et cetera?
Correct, yeah. We have automated samplers on the outlets, and there are six replications. And so it's information that really is not available anywhere else.
Very good. When do you expect to have information for us on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I'm not sure the latest. We've been operating for several years up there now. I know that we have information that's available, but I don't know at what point we're going to be publishing it.
I'd like to see it when it's out.
Certainly, Senator Skoy. So I think that's one project that's really good. We've also focused on a couple of other areas. In particular, drainage water management is an area that we think is of significance and really important, and we've spent a lot of time looking at that. Mr. Chair, our fourth request on page 51 is for the Ag BMP Loan Program. The Ag BMP Loan Program is a long-standing program which makes funds available through a loan and through the local government for implementing all kinds of water protective practices. It's an extremely inexpensive program. It's got about a $100 transaction cost, and of course it's a loan, so the money is paid back into the corpus. and it's available for future loans. It's a very popular program. We have received funding from multiple sources. We have funding, received funding from the Clean Water Fund, which has gone into the corpus of the loan, and it's only available for clean water-related loans. Some of the other loan money is available for other activities. We're not requesting any additional money for the corpus of the loan program, but we do need money in order to legally process the loan requests. And so this funding is a reduction from what we previously requested, and it is only for the administrative costs to process loans that are funded by clean water funds. And any additional money is going to go into the corpus of the program.
How much is in the corpus?
Mr. Chair, I think the total clean water funds is about $13.5 million. The total from all sources is about $75 million.
For this particular fund?
This is for the AgBNP loan program in total.
And that's how much is in the corpus of that particular fund?
Mr. Chair, the total corpus from all sources is $75 million. The total of clean water funds that is in the AgBNP loan program is $13.5 million.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, our fifth request, number five on page 51, is for vegetative cover and soil health. And this is our only new initiative, and we think it's a really good idea. We're excited about it. What it is, frequently what we do is we work with the ag community and others to try to address areas where there are elevated nitrates. And research has shown that the most effective way of doing this is through various vegetative cover tools, in particular forage crops. However, frequently when we work with farmers, they'll say they're very open to doing this, but they need a market. They need a way of selling the crop. And so this initiative, we have an ag marketing and development program. We have a lot of experience in developing markets. And so this is to hire one ag marketer in our ag development program to evaluate and encourage markets for existing crops. And so this is different from all the other vegetative cover initiatives that you're going to see. This is not for something new. What we want to do is to make sure that we've fully explored any existing markets and that we're taking advantage of them and trying to use them on targeted areas of the landscape. And we think there's a real need and opportunity here. Mr. Chair, number six.
Does that one fit into the forever green thing that we were trying to do last year?
Mr. Chair, the activities that we're going to do would support Forever Green and support other vegetative cover initiatives, but it is different. It's not quite the same. We strongly support Forever Green, and in fact, we have funded through research some of their research needs. But this is really focused on markets.
Okay.
It's not quite the same. Mr. Chair, our request number six is on page 51, and that's for clean water technical assistance. This is funding that's used by the departments to demonstrate and evaluate practices on the land. So this is not academic research like our research proposal. This is really for demonstration and evaluation of practices on the land, and then to make sure information from those practices is getting into the hands of people who are actually working on the impaired waters process. So we have three specific goals that we try to do here. We try to demonstrate and evaluate effectiveness of agricultural conservation practices, transfer knowledge about these technologies and practices in support of impaired waters, and then support outreach and education to inform the agricultural community. We've got a number of different activities that are funded under here. I'm going to mention just a couple that are fairly well known. One is Discovery Farms Minnesota. Discovery Farms Minnesota is a farmer-led program to evaluate practices. There's 10 demonstration sites and one special project site across the state. We are an active participant in that, and we think it's a very good program. We strongly support it and have from the beginning. Our role is the monitoring. So we have a specialty. We have staff who are very qualified to do edge-of-field monitoring, which is actually quite difficult to do. And so it requires automated samplers of tile lines and surface water runoff. And you have to be there 365 days a year. So we have people out there in the middle of the winter shoveling these weirs to make sure that we can sample correctly. And then we make sure that the information that's collected is accurate, it's technically defensible, and it's available to the public. So that's our role in Discovery Farms, and we're very supportive of this effort. Another activity that we do is called the Root River Field to Stream Partnership in southeast Minnesota. This is a very innovative proposal or project which consists of three nested monitoring stations in small watersheds. And it's a small watershed scale evaluation of specific practices. We have multiple partners. It's unusual. We've got local farmers and their crop advisors, the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Center, the Nature Conservancy, Fillmore and Maurer County, Monsanto, and numerous other researchers are all involved in this proposal or this program. And we also have other researchers who come in, and since we're doing detailed monitoring, they kind of piggyback onto the work that we're doing to evaluate other monitoring tools and techniques. Then finally, we've got a couple of new technical assistance projects that I'd like to mention. One is actually an old one that was funded by the USDA in cooperation with our agency, and it's the Nutrient Management Initiative. And it was very popular, and we're using technical assistance money to reintroduce it. And what it is it's a farm scale evaluation of practices. So any farmer who chooses to participate and their crop advisor, which we think is important, we will fund them and help them design a strip test of several different practices, either rate, timing, or an nitrification inhibitor. And it allows them to evaluate those practices on their own farm and to get a feel for whether or not that practice is suitable for their farm and whether or not they would be able to use one of these practices to try to reduce the nitrate application on their farm. It's been a very, very popular program. It's a very effective way of getting farmers involved and talking to farmers, you know, directly. And we also make a point of working with their crop advisors in this program. Another initiative, which is fairly new, is the Red River Basin Drainage Water Management Project. This is a project that's got multiple stakeholders, NRCS, Wilton County, the Ag Drainage Water Management Coalition, Buffalo Red Watershed District, Sand County Foundation, and a number of different partners. And what it's going to do is demonstrate and evaluate drainage practices in the Red River Basin. And so there's a lot of interest, a lot of support. It's brand new, just getting started, but we're going to be using technical assistance money to support that initiative. Mr. Chair, our seventh proposal is for something called a research inventory database. This is building on funding already provided from the Clean Water Fund. We have a database that exists. We've developed it. It's successful. And now we just need to manage it and maintain it. So we're lowering our request for just enough money to meet our IT requirements and half a position. And what this does is it is a very simple and easy way to access research on impaired waters and agricultural practices. So there's a lot of information out there. There's something that's called the gray literature, information developed by state agencies and local units of government. And there's no way of getting at this information. This database, which was developed at the request of all of the agencies and other stakeholders, does that. And so this funding is just to maintain the database. Our eighth request is on page 51, for the irrigation water management. And this is pass-through money to the University of Minnesota to maintain an irrigation water management specialist. And this was a position that was developed by our agency at the request of the Minnesota Irrigators Association. And what it does is this is a person who specializes in irrigation and helps develop best management practices and helps educate and promote irrigation management practices with it's passed through the University of Minnesota, but it's done this way intentionally in cooperation with the university. We have an annual contract, and what that does is that makes sure that our agency is used as kind of a bridge to make sure that the work that's done by this person is really well integrated into the impaired waters process. Mr. Chair, our last request, number 9 on page 52, is for increased funding to the Minnesota Ag Water Certification Program. This is a program that currently is being tested in 4 pilot watersheds. It's been supported by the governor and by all of the agencies and a number of other players. And so the pilots will be done in fiscal year 16, and we're ready to go statewide with it. So this funding is to increase our resources to go statewide. Most of the funding is going to be passed through the local government. It will not be spent by the agency. Mr. Chair, that summarizes our clean water funding requests. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to help answer.
Did we get any additional federal money with the water quality program, certification program?
And Mr. Chair, we did. We recently were awarded a $9 million grant from the NRCS Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and that grant does require a match, and we're planning on using clean water funds for the match. and that's a grant over a four-year period, and all of that money, 100%, is for local implementation and local technical support.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stoddard, some of these programs are on the list and of the Clean Water Council and match their numbers. Some of the programs, however, do not. And I was not able to stay for the last two Clean Water Council meetings because I had session here, but I'm wondering what is their comment on the differing amounts. And they're not large, but, I mean, there are some differing amounts. I was wondering what the Clean Water Council had mentioned, if they were going to have to cut other programs or increase something to go along with the governor's recommendations. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, there are some differences between Clean Water Council recommendations and our agency's request. We, of course, support the governor's request. I think that's true for all of the agencies. I think, in general, there's quite a bit of alignment. There's a few that are off just a little bit, and some money got moved around. There's a couple of things that are not in agreement. And I would have to, you know, I could talk about each one generally, but I'd be somewhat reluctant to speak for the Clean Water Council. I know that they were trying to shift as much money as they could into Bowser and local implementation. But I know also they have different reasons for different decisions.
On number nine, that's a voluntary program, correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely, yes. It's a voluntary program.
And have we started it yet? And if
Mr. Chair, we have four pilots going on right now, and the pilots are going to be running for 3 years, and it will end in fiscal year 16. Each one's a little bit different, and generally we're very, very pleased with the way they're going. We have, I think, a total of 31 farmers that are signed up so far, but that's a little misleading because I think the total number of farmers who are interested is 260, and it's only about 2% of the land. So compared to any other program done in the nation, I think we're starting off far ahead of some of the other activities there.
So when you say four pilots, they're all trying to approach the same problem from four different ways? Is that what you're thinking?
No, Mr. Chair, they're in different parts of the state. So we wanted to evaluate the best way of deploying this program in areas that have different agricultural systems. Each one's a little bit different, but generally that's the main difference.
Okay. Well, any other questions, comments? Okay. Do you have any relatives in Chisholm?
Sure, not that I know of.
Bob Stoddard graduated with me. So. Anyway. Okay. Who's next?
Mr. Chair, our next two divisions do not have any change items. They'll be going through a brief overview of their divisions at your request. They will be very brief considering the number of testifiers we have today. So we have here today Mr. Gary Horvath, who runs our lab, and he'll be giving the committee an overview of the lab.
Thank you, Mr. Horvath. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Horvath. I'm the director of the Laboratory Services Division at the Department of Agriculture. The page 66 and 67 in your book covers the lab. I'm just going to talk a little bit about how the lab relates to the three divisions you've heard. As a regulatory enforcement and monitoring lab, we implement methods specific to the needs of the agency to meet some of the programs you've heard. We identify emerging issues, produce methodology for potential regulation or increased monitoring. We also do routine test methods to support regulatory decision making and monitoring programs, we provide data that is legally and scientifically defensible. And the legally and scientifically defensible part is becoming more and more important with FSMA and some of the federal requirements for use of state data by the feds and our partners. So in 2012, we became accredited to the ISO International Standards Organization Lab Standard 17025. We're continuing to implement this throughout the various program areas of the lab. And basically, accreditation is a system of continuous improvement. We do formal root cause and problem solving. We found it to be very valuable in producing better data to support some of the things you've just heard from PFMD and from Dairy Food and Mr. Frizzo's Plant Protection Division. We also are the DNR's laboratory for eco services. We do lakes and stream surveys. We do the fish consumption advisory, the PCB and mercury analysis for the DNR. So, you know, why all this effort on accreditation? Well, it instills confidence in the integrity and validity of lab data used in decision making. Program managers have confidence when they take action on our data. And the regulated community has confidence that the accurate information is being used when judging their actions or activities. Data is acceptable for, as I said, for use by the feds and other government partners. We provide fit-for-purpose data. In other words, we have a lot of the methods you heard Mr. Stoddard talk about, our water monitoring program. Those analytes, we work with them very closely to identify, you know, what it is we should be looking for in Minnesota. We're not using, you know, federal methods. We're zeroing in on the issues, and the lab works very closely with our partners to have fit-for-purpose data for their decision-making. Data is being looked at more and more by the public and the regulated community, so we see challenges, so we're constantly aware of quality as everything in the lab, and so that's a large part of our recent efforts is improving those systems. So we contribute to a healthy Minnesota through food safety. We do pathogen analysis. You might have heard about the recent caramel apple outbreak. We were involved with that. We do species identification for allergens and that type of thing. We do pesticide residues in food products, compliance testing for label verification. We administer the pasteurized milk ordinance that allows the interstate shipment of milk and toxin identification, things like in the past, like melamine and milk protein, that type of thing. So we get involved with that. We cooperate with the USDA and FDA. We're one of the initial cooperative agreement labs under the Food Emergency Response Network. So we receive money from the federal government to develop capability and methodology for select agents, which are biological agents and chemical agents that could be used to attack the food supply. So we work with them. We receive grant money to do that. And also under that program, we get involved with national outbreaks or chemical instances. I mentioned melamine. We have with the nationwide outbreaks, such as, you know, the peanut butter and this candied apple thing. We also were involved with the Horizon oil spill. We developed the methodology to analyze shellfish, and because we led the way on that, we were able to test shellfish in Minnesota, making sure that it wasn't contaminated. So it benefits the citizens of Minnesota by being in the foreground of things as they develop. As you heard just now, we monitor inorganic nutrients, pesticides in water. We get involved with pesticide enforcement cases. We get human exposure, drifts, spills, everything that Mr. Buzicki and Mr. Stoddard talked about in their programs. So we get involved with that. We look a little bit at compositional chemistry of fertilizer and, you know, what's in there and levels and meeting, again, label verification, that type of thing. And we also provide for a clean environment through the DNR. As I said, we do the hatchery permits for discharge into the natural waters of the state from the DNR. We do nutrient mineral analysis, lakes and stream surveys, and we respond to fish kills that the DNR may encounter. We have a very limited plant disease testing program, we also do seed analysis and germination and purity and some genetically modified traits. So basically, I'll end my testimony by, you know, the robust lab is the foundation of sound decision making for these regulatory programs, and you know, we develop those methods and we're always available to work with them on issues as they arise. So with that, I'll take any questions you may have.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Horvath?
Yes.
You talked about testing for consumption of fish. I have a, in my area, unlike some of these other gentlemen at the table, I have an overstocking of, not, I shouldn't say that. We have a lot of, we had a lot of fresh fish, a lot of walleye on the dinner table in our in the neck of the woods, and I just want to know, a serious question here. I know there was a consumption alert some years ago about consuming fish in Minnesota. Can you tell me where that is now versus where it was 15 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the lab, we don't analyze the data. We turn that data over to the DNR, who works with the pollution control agency. So we do not analyze the trends. I can't really speak to that. You'd have to talk to the DNR. But generally, in the big river systems are contaminated. Things seem to be looking at the data superficially, pretty static. We expect levels of mercury in certain areas, and it seems to be fairly static. But again, I'm not qualified to. I don't interpret that data. We just generate it. We don't do the analysis of trends in the environment. We're basically producing it for them.
Galsy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Horvath, it's interesting to hear that your lab works on, for instance, the peanut butter and the caramel apples. So does the Department of Health also have a lab, or do you give information to the Department of Health? Because they're involved in these sorts of issues as well.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. We're co-located with the Health Department over right next to the Freeman Building and the lab building on 12th and Robert. So they're right across the hallway from us. The health department, the way that works generally is the health department sees an outbreak first. They get human cases reported from the doctors. They have an epidemiological process where they look for, they question the patient on what they ate, and they kind of zero in on a commodity or some food source. And you heard Dr. Ben Miller here last time, the Dairy and Food Inspection Division. They work closely with health to then go out and try to locate and do trace back, find the product, get the actual product, find out where it came from, look at lot numbers, trace it back. Those samples are submitted to us. We analyze it. We try to isolate it from the food product. And then if we do isolate it, we just walk across the aisle, give it to health, and then they do the genetic ID, the pulse field gel electrophoresis, and then they put that in their system. And if that matches to the outbreak strain, that's kind of the full circle connect the case that, yes, in fact, this is the source. And we work very closely with the health department. Their lab basically, they're looking for what comes out. We're looking for what goes in. We do the food, and they get the problem at the end. And so, yes, very same organisms, very different type of work.
Thank you.
A lot of ways to take that. They get what goes out.
Get what goes in. Excuse me.
Nothing. It's okay. Anything else? Okay. And as far as your general fund is concerned, or all your expenditures, there's a little bit of an increase, looks like to me.
Yeah, we have $40,000 that was given to us to take when we took back the St. Paul inspections. We saw a big increase in filth and foreign matter samples and other pathogen tests. So we were given that adjustment in our general fund. The lion's share, 44% of our general fund, pays for the building, the rent to the Department of Administration. It's a complicated building. It's got a lot of expensive systems to run, and it's very costly. And then a large portion of our budget goes to the operational running of the building. We have water systems that we have to service. We have to service our biosafety cabinets, and so the operational expenses of the building. And then we use a lot of the lab has our operational support kind of people who accept samples and do do very support all the various programs. We try to put them under general funds. So then the what's left of that, the lion's share goes to, I would say, to food safety analysis, because food doesn't have a dedicated fund, so that generally historically has been where we put that money. We support some nutrient monitoring, the nutrient sampling for pesticide and fertilizer management, and a little bit for some plant testing. But that's pretty much in general how that breaks out in the lab.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mary Hanks from our Ag Marketing Division.
Hanks, welcome. Just say your name for the record.
My name is Mary Hanks. I'm the Director of the Ag Marketing and Development Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As Mr. Cruz said, I don't have any change items this time, so I'm just going to do a very brief update. I know the schedule's full and you'd like to talk to Commerce as well. So the Ag Marketing and Development Division is just full of very diverse responsibilities, everything from ag literacy to international trade to local foods like Minnesota Grown. In addition, you can look on page 76 of your book, or there is also a handout with a few PowerPoint slides. I'm going to be working off the PowerPoint slides, but the detail is on page 76. My division, in addition to some of the responsibilities I'm going to be talking about, also administers, invests the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Funds. That information can be found on page 81 in your budget book. So page 76 and page 81 in the budget book. The Ag Marketing and Development Division promotes the production and marketing of Minnesota food, fiber, feed, and fuel. We work to create a climate conducive to profitable agriculture that protects our natural resources as well as meets the demands of the marketplace. We focus on three areas: production assistance, access to markets, and business development and ag education. Under production assistance, this is page 3 of the handout. In the interest of time, I'm only going to highlight a few areas, but you can see that in production assistance, we do assist with livestock, ag water and conservation technology, immigrant and underserved farmers, biofuels, local and organic foods, and crop research. I'd like to highlight some of the work that we do with the dairy profitability teams. Those funds go out to local teams made up of farm business management instructors, bankers, feed and nutrition advisors, veterinarians, extension people, to work with individual farm families. We're currently working with 287 farm families. In the house yesterday, we brought one of those, a young farm family who's been working with one of those teams for about 3 years to testify and just talk about their farm and how the team has helped them. Also, I'd like to point out, too, some of the work we've been doing with some of the immigrant farming communities. We do some group education, some one-on-one help, anything from working with pesticide and fertilizer management to help those new farmers handle pesticides and fertilizers appropriately. We've been working with farm business management to get them business planning and financial assistance. And we work with all of the immigrant groups from Hmong, Latino, Somali, any of those groups that have people who want to farm. In crop research, this is mostly funds that come through the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Fund. We provide grants for new crops, for management practices, disease, insect control. Most of these funds do go to the university. We focus these funds primarily, I don't want to call them orphan crops, but crops that don't have a lot of research dollars available to them already. We've funded some of the Forever Green work on perennials, barley, wild rice, some of the crops that don't have that research capability through through the promotion councils. If you move on to the next slide, one area that we focus on is access to markets. Like I mentioned, we do everything from Minnesota Grown, which is very local direct marketing, to international trade. You're probably familiar with the Minnesota Grown program. It's been around for 25 years. We currently have about 1,200 farms and farmers markets that are licensed to use that Minnesota Grown logo and to receive all the point of sale materials that we provide to those licensees. The online directory this year has almost 300,000 unique hits, consumers that are going to that site to find places to buy local meat, vegetables, fruit, Christmas trees, just about anything that we grow here in Minnesota. For international trade, we host buyer's missions from all over the world. We work with federal and state federal agencies with promotion councils to do trade missions. We led trade missions to Vietnam with the feed industry. We do Minnesota pavilions at various international shows in China, Dubai, Europe. We recruit companies to go, mostly small and medium-sized companies that it's very difficult for them to go on their own. We put the Minnesota pavilion, the name Minnesota, out there in these pavilions. We take our companies with us. We think having that name Minnesota speaks for quality and integrity, and want to attract people there and get those Minnesota companies all together. Moving on to business development, the next slide. Here's where the agri money comes into focus. We have focused those dollars, and I would love to come back and talk to you in more detail about agri. I know in the interest of time, I won't get into the detail you want. But we focused on investing dollars in livestock producers, in value-added businesses, in farm-to-school, getting Minnesota products into schools, beginning and transitioning farmers. We've been doing food company promotions at domestic shows, and we have funded research on energy and on crops and invested in getting blender pumps into more service stations so that people have access to more E15 and more E85.
So are these two people in this picture from the Red River Valley Potatoes, are they direct competitors with Senator Scoy, or are you part of
what pictures are you looking at?
I'm looking at this picture on the business development page.
What are you looking at?
It's all right.
Look.
I don't think he sells his potatoes in Minnesota, though, so it'd be okay. You don't have to answer that one.
I'm not planning on it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. Go
ahead. We didn't put that picture in his packet.
In my copy of the picture is so small I can't even see who's in there. So
we're finding that to be consistent with all the departments putting things in too small for us to read them. So
one of the other areas where we were active in business development is in the organic industry. We use federal funds that are made available to us to provide cost share for organic certification. This past year, we used federal funds, just over $400,000, to provide 75% of organic of 529 organic farmers and processors cost to be certified. And then finally, under education, the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom program is in my division. We focus on K through 12 ag literacy. 44% of elementary and middle schools use our AgMag, and We also have AgMag Junior and all sorts of other associated materials that are used all over the state and are used as models in some other states for their programs. Since 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the legislature provided funds for us to hire an ag educator. And since we've hired her in the last year, she has had contact with 866 pre-service and in-service ag teachers to help them understand how to, not just ag teachers, all teachers, to get to use agriculture as a way to teach science, history, English, and social studies. All the materials we put out meet the standards that curriculum that teachers need to meet for the state, and she's just been a wonderful addition and has really improved our contact with teachers. The last two slides are some performance measures, which I believe I already spoke to. I'd love to answer questions and would love to come back and talk about Agri in more detail.
Well, as long as you brought that up, how much of the Agri fund do you actually use in your business development area? I think it's a $20 million fund, if I'm not
it's
mistaken.
It's a $20 million fund for the biennium. The value-added grants so far, this is fiscal year 13 and 14, we have invested $3.2 million, and we are just closing another round of grants where we have another $1.2 million to invest.
Okay. So the rest of the funds are being invested by somebody else in the ag division?
No, my division's responsible for the whole $20.4 million.
Mr. Chair, I think the confusion is that you used a term that's very close to one of the five programs that's funded through Agri.
Okay.
And so if you're looking at Agri, totally all the money leaves the door every biennium. However, it's in one of these five different programs run within the umbrella of Agri that is covered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if in this Agri fund, if you and or in any other funds here, that you give any help to the these groups that are growing greens and I think it's a limited stock with the aquaponics or the I don't know if you give them any assistance. There's a large one on the east side in Ham's Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of what you fund with your agri-growth?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that particular business has not received any funds from us yet for, one of the owners works for the department, so they are not eligible. But the other one that I'm aware of, Garden Fresh Produce, which is I think up on Como, has received grant funds to help them expand.
Okay. How about Silver Bay?
I would have to look. I didn't bring a list of all the grantees.
I think they have an aquaponics thing going on up there too, so.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to look and see if they've received funds or not.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, before Mr. Cruz leaves.
Wait, Mr. Cruz, don't go anywhere.
I thought we had one more presenter in. But Mr. Cruz, the last time we were here, we had some conversation about the wolf deprivation compensation. I asked a question about federal and state trappers, and the indication was that there were federal and state trappers operating in the state. I since have received information that there's one. And if you could clarify that for me, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair and Senator, you're absolutely right. There is one. I believe it was Gear for Zoe who had testified there was something like 10 or 15. I believe that was a historical number. Your number is accurate, and I've talked with Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union as well and gotten that updated information. So your number is correct. It is one.
And so, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cruz, does the department have any proposals to bring that number closer to what the historical number has been?
Mr. Chair and members, that's the kind of proposal, that kind of funding would come through the DNR or through USDA. That's not something that we've funded in the past, so that would be a new line item for us, and that would be something that we'd have to talk to the DNR about.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So Mr. Ernst is here just for general questions? Is that what?
He's our CFO, and so we needed to call backup. He was our phone a friend.
Mr. Bond, you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have a handout that I believe staff will hand out. It's actually two items. One is the letterhead from which I'm going to provide my testimony points. The other is a limited number of letters to the Commissioner of Agriculture from the ACRA board. If I can, my name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We're a very small trade association representing those folks that provide chemicals, both fertilizer and pesticides and seeds, and the services to farmers through the agronomy department of most of the co-ops in the state and a few independents. Wanted to talk about an item that wasn't included in the governor's budget, and it's one that I wanted you to be aware of at least. The Ag Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account, the ACRA account, if you will, was created to reimburse persons for costs included in cleaning up agricultural pesticide incidents. The account is funded by annual surcharges on pesticide and fertilizer manufacturers, distributors, applicators, and dealers. The Commissioner of Ag himself determines a surcharge rate. The ACRA account is administered by a board, and they're a five-member board that represents ag chemical registrants, manufacturers, dealers, farmers, and the Department of Ag and Commerce. And so this fund is basically an agricultural superfund, if you will, funded entirely by agricultural product surcharges. You'll see in the third bullet point the surcharge amounts, the different categories before 2015, and then you'll see the ones for this year, that the way that they've gone up. In 2010, the ACRA surcharges were reduced by approximately 67% from levels set in 2005. Because the fund was above its statutory limit. Everyone has an interest in seeing that doesn't get too high, so it was a $5 million account at that time. Since that time, program expenditures, reimbursements, transfers have exceeded the revenues as it's designed to do, and the fund balance declined. Then at the time of the budget deficit issues in the legislature, transferred $1.5 million from the ACRA user fund to the general budget. They did by act. It was a million of it was done in fiscal year 2011, and a half million was done in fiscal year 13, and that went to the general fund. The ACRA balance was above $5 million at that time. That was the maximum statutory amount, so that was obviously a target for some reduction by the legislature. Based on reimbursement trends and so on, in 2014, the MDA projected that the fund balance would drop below the minimum statutory $1 million limit, and they consulted with the ACRA board. The board concurred, said, yes, we suggest you raise the rates. That was done, but they also, in that action, asked the commissioner to request from the governor a repayment of this account in the governor's budget. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. That is, the governor didn't accede to the commissioner who made the request on behalf of this board. We respectfully request that the funds be transferred to the general fund and restore the ACRA fund as it was taken out. If I just comment, the other item is just the letter that came from the board itself to the commissioner. If I could comment on just one other item in terms of the department has been working very diligently in terms of regulating fertilizer and pesticide containment and services and products. And the industry itself has also been very responsive, not only in cooperating and working with the department, but subsequent to that disaster in Texas in which a large explosion in a fertilizer plant created a very big disaster and hurt a number of people and killed a few others. The industry itself got together and decided it needed to do something in terms of self-regulation. And so they developed what now is termed the basically a fertilizer fund called Responsible Ag, and it is an industry-funded, industry-created third-party audit of all of the fertilizer facilities in the country. And they are currently enrolling the facilities. A number of them have already come in. They are training auditors who will be third-party independent inspectors. And that combined with the chemical bulk pesticide plant and containment inspection that goes on from the pesticide industry, I think demonstrates that the industry is very interested in being responsible, not only for the environment, but for safety of their workers in the community. And I might hasten to add that this organization and this concept was created based upon an initiative that our own organization developed several years ago in cooperation with the Department of Ag, in which we developed an audit, an independent third-party audit, that any member could participate in, that would audit all of the regulations that apply to a fertilizer, pesticide, or seed, or for that matter, fertilizer plant. And we think that set a great example, and it's been adopted nationwide. So with that, I'd stand for any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bond. So in 2013, there was a $5 million balance. Monies flowed in. Now we're projected to go under $1 million. What happened in those 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, that might be more appropriate to the department if they would want to address that.
Mr. Chair, Greg Bezicki with the department. I don't have it with me, but we've actually filed a report. We file annual reports on the ACRA program and the balance and the funds. The fund is by statute is required to maintain a balance between $1 and $5 million. Never really know what the business is going to be until the applications come in within a month or so of when the board meets. The board meets 5 or 6 times a year, processes these amounts. Basically, what happened is in 2008, 2009, and thereabouts, the fund, if you will, is driven by the fact that we have cleanup staff, technical people that go out and oversee these cleanups that take place. You might think of them as, for a simple analysis, insurance adjusters. The pesticide regulatory account pays the salaries on those. The cleanup fund does not pay salaries for the staff. And what happened is we didn't have adequate funds in our pesticide and fertilizer account to pay for staff. So we were down staff. And basically, just like if you're down insurance adjusters, you're not getting money out the door. We weren't able to process the application. So the fund balance grew. And at the same time, if you recall, the ag economy was cooking. So there was more revenue coming in, and we were processing less of these applications. That's the reason for the fund to grow. And then in 2010, the commissioner adjusted the fees and dropped them down by a third, so to maintain the balance between that $1 and $5 million level. Those reductions took place. We were able to actually get a pesticide fee increase and be able to fund the staff. So we began processing more applications. In the meantime, we're operating the fund was operating on its reserve and a one-third level of income that was coming in. And as we saw that fund balance dropping, we took some conservative measures to make sure that we could protect the fund as much as possible. At the same time, the commissioner's responsibility was actually to maintain it above that $1 million level. The commissioner made that decision in 2014, late 2013. Those funds are now coming in, and we anticipate, and we've staffed up, And so we anticipate the revenues and expenditures will be in balance. So I believe the board and the board is supportive, the ACRA board is supportive of that, the commissioner and the staff. So we now have a situation where we're kind of back at the level playing field. Mr. Bond is talking about the fact that in previous bieniums to balance tails, there were some funds that were taken from the ACRA fund when money was in the account and transferred to the general fund to balance some of the tails. And he's asking for that a total of $1.5 million to be reimbursed to the ACRA fund that came from the general fund. The department, this is not in the governor's budget. The governor, certainly this was considered, but the governor, it is not in the governor's budget, that transfer. So, and Mr. Chair, Senator, all of this is spelled out very nicely, much better than I can describe in the ACRA report, and I'd be happy to provide that report to the committee.
Just real quickly, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Bond, on your handout, what's the before January 2015 and the after January 2015? Looks like there's quite an increase there. I just heard him say that they're going to be in balance. What are we referring to?
Mr. Chairman, I had a little trouble hearing you, Senator.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at your handout, crop production retailers.
Yes.
And in the middle, you've got ACRA surcharges before January 15th and then appears after January 2015. The commercial pesticide licenses are going from $825 to $25. License fees going from $16. What is all that about if we're back in balance?
Mr. Chairman, that's just a delineation of the increases that were put into that account. And maybe Mr. Bezicki can help us with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in 2010, Commissioner Hugesson reduced the surcharges to one-third of their rate to address the fact that the balance was high. And so the numbers that you see were the one-third rate. Commissioner Fredrickson and his decision moved them back up to the original level. So the industry and all those payers will be paying the same rate that they were paying back in the 2005 to 2010 period. So it's just restored. And that will bring the fund balance up to the level that we think we will. That will bring the revenue in at a particular level that we'll be able to expend on an annual basis. So we'll have a match with that. And Mr. Chair and Senator, if you recall in my testimony, we know that this sooner or later goes to the farmers. They pay these fees, and this is one of the things that I guess the farmers fail to get enough credit. Farmers and pesticide users, because it's urban folks as well, they've paid for millions and millions, $34 million worth of cleanup in 1,000 sites around the state through this fund. So we've really done a great deal to remove contamination from the soil and get it properly disposed of and protect the environment. So it's a really wonderful program that's worked very, very quietly but very wonderfully well over many years.
And Mr. Chair, I have one final question for Mr. Bond then. And Mr. Bond, so you're not really, you're just commenting on the going back to the earlier fee rates, but you would like the $1.5 million that was used for budget deficit reduction return to the ACRA fund. Is that what primarily you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, that is precisely right.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Okay, thanks. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'll be very brief. Just wanted to comment on the governor's budget proposal. We were, pleased to see a lot of the big items are supported, like Minnesota Grown, dairy development, agri funds. We have two other things that are very important to us that are funded at an increased level in the governor's budget are the wolf depredation that we've talked about quite a bit. Very important to our members. I think you've heard a lot about that. There is a federal program that's been talked about some, but it is quite different. And we just had a meeting last week in Senator Lori's district where we had 70 farmers come some of them from St. Louis, Carlton, kind of the hot spot for wolves, that have looked into that issue. And one of the things about the federal program, it requires them to go to the county FSA office in St. Louis County. They've closed the office. It's only open in Duluth on Wednesdays. In Aiken County, it's only open, I believe, on Thursdays. And so there's a lot of different issues there. People are familiar with the state program. They like the way it works, and we encourage you to consider funding that program as well. Also, it's been told when you get reimbursed for losing, you get reimbursed for the market price for that animal. And what strikes me is it's not always just calves. I think farmers are losing a lot of cows, which is interesting. When you lose a cow, you're not raising it to slaughter in the fall. You're raising it to also maybe have 5, 6, 7 calves. So it's going to keep producing. So just a point that I feel some of our members don't feel gets heard enough. The other one is increased money for meat inspectors as our local food is grown, and a lot of our farmers are using local plants and they want to sell from there. I'm really pleased to see Farmers Union is that was included in the governor's budget. Finally, I'd just like to say nobody likes fees. Our members are included in that. There are several fees that are proposed to be raised in this budget. The ones that are most interesting that we've heard from our members are the dairy inspection fee, the feed inspection fee, and the anhydrous inspection fee. None of those fees are going to put anybody out of business, and I appreciate working with Mr. Cruz and the department to show that in most cases those are going to be are going to cost farmers under $100 a year and are not like I said, going to put anybody out of business. But I think farmers wonder, with the surplus we have, and we'll find out more about that on Friday, is it necessary at this time? The one that we hear the most about is the dairy inspection fee raising from $50 to $150, and trying to work with the department, because that's a tripling of that fee. And again, not necessarily paid directly by the farmer, but the farmer will see that cost passed down. And I think farmers will hear about these fees as they look at them, because remember, if you're a feed mill or anhydrous or a dairy, those are co-ops owned by farmers and managed by a farm board. So thank you for your consideration.
Is the wolf depredation money, is that enough?
Mr. Chair, I think that's something we'll have to look at. The other issue is people right now, the state account is out of money now. And so, I think we're still telling people to submit the claims, and we're optimistic that the legislature may, put money in to pay claims now. And I think that's the concern, is there going to be enough? And then what happens with the claims this year? I'm frankly, I just anecdotally, the calls I get every day, with the low snow we've had, I think we're going to have a healthy population of wolves, and we're just starting calving now, and people are losing cattle now.
Senator Westrom.
So I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, on the fee issue, is Farmers Union on record supporting these fee increases or asking that they be scaled back or not imposed if we can help it? I wasn't sure.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, we're still looking at them and working with the department on them and see what kind of bills. Again, we would prefer there not be any fee increases, but, and that would go every year. I think that these are reasonable fee increases with regards, though, to the dairy. That one, for sure, we'd like to see some change, and we definitely have had our members ask us to look at that and say that's too high.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, that one's paid by the farmer directly when the inspector comes out to their farm, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, and maybe Mr. Cruz can remind me, but I'm told that it's paid by the processor, but that is passed on to the farmer. It's going to be, and it's also twice a year if you're an A inspection and once if you're a B inspection, so...
Mr. Chair and Senators, this is Santa Cruz, Department of Ag. You're both right. There's two different aspects of it. The grade A, grade B, which I believe is what Mr. Peterson was referencing, does go to the co-op. That's the people buying the fluid milk from the farmer. So that tripling fee that he referenced does go to the purchaser, the Land O'Lakes, or whomever purchases from the farm. But the on-farm inspection fee that Senator Westrum referenced is going up as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Cruz, what is that going up for the on-farm inspection?
Mr. Chair, members, the on-farm inspection, and I wish that Drs. Kneeser and Miller were here, could give you a little bit more detail, but my understanding is that through the Interstate Compact of Milk Shipments, that it's a general cleanliness, preparedness, and equipment review with the department, but I could get you more details on that via email.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, if we're in February now and we're out of money and we're heading into calving seasons, we're going to have this year of wolf deprivation plus next year. I mean, it looks to me like we can't budget this for 1 year. We need to be looking at a little longer term. And I can't imagine, Mr. Chair, that we aren't going to need some additional resources. It's February now.
You should probably get us a better estimate of what we're going to need before we do all the budgeting here, because it looks to me like we're probably going to need more too. So just now, you don't have to tell me now.
Well, okay. Mr. Chair, I would just comment in saying that the doubling from 200,000 in the biennium to 400,000 over the next biennium was not contemplating the fund running out currently. So I think you are correct in saying that there will be increased claims upon the fund that the current amount wouldn't satisfy, including what's going on right now. We were the beneficiary of a USDA grant program that allowed us to shore up a little bit of that. But as Mr. Peterson testified, we absolutely expect this spring to be a horrible spring for wolf depredation. Considering the weather, considering the increased numbers, considering the farmers aren't allowed to take them themselves. And you also have to remember that cattle prices are going up, which is a good thing for farmers. However, that means that if you're paying for a calf today, the fund will be receiving a bigger hit in the future if those prices do go up, because we pay the market value.
All right. Oh, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that vein, do you know how much per, I guess I come from the world of complaints, but per incident that you go out, how much time and effort do you spend, or is there spent on the wolf deprivation issue? Roughly, do you know? There's about 250 of them that are, I think, trapped at one, right in that area every year.
Mr. Chair and members, I can get better information from you back from the department. I know we do have those numbers. But what I would say is, with regard to the depredation account, that is solely a reimbursement account. We don't have people out in the field. That's done by sheriff's offices up in your neck of the woods, as well as throughout the Wolf Range, and anybody who's been trained through the program to find the standard that they use is the preponderance of the evidence, greater weight that a wolf did this than that a wolf didn't. And once that is substantiated, they submit that paperwork to us, and we process the claim.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Ms. Lemke.
Run.
Go ahead.
Hello, Chairman and committee members. My name is Laura Lemke, and I'm representing the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association today. We just wanted to be on record as saying, in regards to the governor's budget proposal on the feed tonnage tax and inspection fee program, that we do not support the changes. Truthfully, we haven't had a lot of time to consider the changes that the department is proposing. On the face of these changes, the increased tonnage tax / fees are a huge increase to the feed industry at approximately a 61% increase from 16 cents to 26 cents. We don't feel it's fair that the feed industry is being requested to shoulder the brunt of these costs. And we would like some more time to speak with the department and perhaps find and explore better ways to approach the feed program deficits at this time. In short, we are willing to consider alternative options, but we feel that we can't support a 61% tonnage tax increase, and those fees in the end will be passed along to farmers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Ms. Lemke? Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. I appreciate the feedback, and you may want to work with her.
Mr. Chair, I have met with the Grain and Feed Association several times. Mr. Bob Zelenka and I have had lunch on this very issue. I am 100% confident we will get to a place of agreement with the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Mr. Zelenka and I have been working together very well.
Okay, thank you. All right. Commissioner Rothman, do you want to make an opening statement or something today? We've only got about 5 minutes, and I apologize for that, but it's up to you. You can wait until next week if you want, or you can start out today if you want. How would you like to proceed?
No, let's just wait. That's fine.
You want to wait? Okay. All right. Okay.
I'll come back anyway.
Yeah, we're all going to be around here, so. Okay. I apologize. I didn't expect to take that long, but anyway, thank you for waiting it out, and then we'll see you next week then, okay? All right. All right. Thank you very much, and then meeting adjourned.
Some time.
Yeah.